This is Melissa, and it is the 16th of February, 2025, and I hope that you are all doing well. I just wanted to check in and give you a bit of an update of things and maybe make a few points before I turn this over to an old talk from Alan Watt for you. I have been unwell, and you might hear that in my voice. I've had a sinus infection, and it's got me down for a couple of weeks, but I am getting better. And around that is some more serious illness in my extended family and trying to help out there, and also taking on the big project, which I started before I got the sinus infection, of helping my Aunt Betty go through her house, get rid of a lot of things, and help her prepare to downsize into a more manageable situation for her. And I knew that this would be a big project, but as I've gotten in and assessed it and seen what lies ahead, I understand that this will be keeping me busy for some time to come. A couple of months, I would think, at the least, and I'm giving her a few hours every day. So it's a lot, but she is pleased, so grateful, and I'm also finding that in many ways, it's rewarding to do this. So I'm glad that I'm able to do that. And then I'm glad that I'm well enough to do that. Just a couple of days ago, I carted out about 125 pounds of clothes from her house. And we're just getting started. I want to thank you all for the support that you gave me trying to reach my goal of paying the property taxes. This was a big burden, and I appreciate it. I appreciate those of you who purchased the flash drives, which was very helpful, and I'm so pleased to be able to offer those to you. I think they're beautiful, and I've heard from a few of you who've received them, and you also think they're beautiful, and so I still have those for, if you want them, you can buy them as a set, or you can buy them individually. And it's helpful to me, as well as I just feel good that I'm offering something so lovely that encompasses almost all of Alan's work for you, really all of his work except his two books. So thank you for that. So a few quick updates here. On Saturday, the 22nd of February, in the Telegram CTTM channel, we will be covering Graham, myself, and Darren, the last chapter, yay, unbelievable, the last chapter of Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. And this is chapter 20. It's entitled The Future in Perspective. And so that's a huge milestone. We've been at this for a year, 14 months, I think it has taken us to cover this book. And I don't think we're going to miss a beat. I haven't discussed this to nail down the time of the first recording that we'll do on Alan Watt's Waiting for the Miracle. But this was suggested by Prince that we cover Alan's books next. It's a good idea. I don't know why I didn't think of it. And so the March reading assignment, for those of you who want to be participating in book club, is Alan Watt's Waiting for the Miracle. We haven't set a reading schedule yet, but I would say that it would be at least the introduction and the first interview. That's not that big a section, maybe 20 pages. And of course, that is available. I'm happy if you order that, I'll be happy to make that book up for you. I'm just kind of reminded that Alan is telling you about the process of getting an order out in this talk that I'm about to play. So I don't believe that I'm going to offer a real history on the 20th, but at the end of the month, there's something that I have already pre-recorded with Sam in Australia, And so you'll have that. And then on the 6th of March, Nick Hayes from Hayes Reviews and I will be discussing the novel by Yevgeny Zamyatin entitled We. And Nick checked in with me and said that this was a couple of days ago, he was at record 13. And those of you who are reading along will understand what the record is. He's at record 13, page 69. And oh my goodness, but because of illness and all of the busyness of my life, I hadn't started reading and I felt bad about that. So yesterday I embarked on the novel We, and I reached record 4, page 12. It's 200 pages, but I do have time. So, and you have time too if you're reading along. We'll discuss this 6th March. Prince wrote me last week, I think. And he sent some suggestions, which I always appreciate hearing, of different talks. And I decided to play one of those for you today. And this is Alan Watt from March 28, 2007. And the title of this is Predatory Pathocracy, Psychopathy and Their Prey, The Passive Public. So Predatory Pathocracy, Psychopathy and Their Prey, The Passive Public. That's a bit of a tongue twister there. And this talk was before I was in Canada with Alan, and it would have been in the vein of the kind of talks that Alan would deliver from time to time, in which he would talk about being run off his feet or how busy he was or what he was doing. And in this case, he was putting together book orders, sitting on the floor, you know, doing that. And I just would think to myself, why is no one helping Alan? Why is there no one up there cooking and help and putting together orders? And I finally said, then it must be me. In this talk, it's kind of low-key, but it is a profound talk with many, many amazing points that he brings up and things that are thought-provoking. And it's just, I could say, as usual, full of that kind of wisdom, but it is an excellent talk. It's not Alan at his most pumped up, you know, ranting. Not that he was much of a ranter, but, you know, when he gets going with his disgust, that kind of a talk, it's not that. It's just very low-key, but thought-provoking. And at one point he said, back in the 1970s, for the first time, I remember a parliament in Britain that spoke up and said, you know, we might get hit with a comet or an asteroid, and we should make some new kind of category of defense to protect ourselves against it. And this is what the beginning of what they had been talking about, a threat from out there. And that kind of made me laugh, smile to myself when I heard that, because last month in all of the major newspapers, I saw something about an asteroid that had a 1-point-something percentage chance of hitting the Earth. And so I looked that story up again this morning, and I saw that, sure enough, it just made the news again a couple of days ago. 2024 YR4, that's the name of the asteroid, 2024 YR4. What we know about the asteroid that could hit Earth, there is an estimated 2.3% chance that the 2024 YR4 asteroid is heading our way. Here's everything you need to know about the space rock, including how much damage it could actually cause. This is not a drill. There is a chance, albeit a small one, that an asteroid could hit planet Earth within the next decade. The 2024 YR4 asteroid set off automated asteroid warning systems after it was spotted through advanced telescopes in Rio Hurtado, Chile, last December. Since then, the asteroid has jumped to the top of the risk list, a catalog of all space objects which could possibly clash with our planet. It's far from panic stations, but experts say the probability of an impact with Earth has almost doubled from 1.2% in January to about 2.3% now. But how much do we know about the asteroid, and when will we know for sure if we're safe? Plus, what could happen if it really is heading our way? And it goes on with lots of what-ifs and possibilities. So, in this talk, Alan said that governments exist. The only way that they can exist is if they are creating fear. That it's the fear that they create that allows them to maintain their position, their power position. So that's just something to think about. And because I have been busy with other things, I'm not looking at much of the so-called news, but a couple of things that jump out at me are Trump's continuing discussion about Greenland and calling Canada the 51st state. And I'll put up an article from a couple of days ago from the CBC in Canada. Allies appear to duck and cover as Trump threatens Canada and Greenland. And there is another article from NPR News, that's National Public Radio. Red, white, and blue land. Trump's Greenland talk sparks some colorful proposals. In this talk, Alan also mentions Africa and the fact that if there's plans on the book, those are going to go forward. You can bank on it, no matter how long it takes to pull it off. And that made me think in Tragedy and Hope Book Club, we discussed Africa just a little bit, and I wanted to point out a couple of things for you. I'm just going to put up some wiki links on the African Union. This was at the time of Tragedy and Hope writing, called, I believe, the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, and it's now the African Union. This is a continental union of 55 member states. And one of the things that's come out of this, Darren and Andrea have talked about this on their Telegram channels, is Agenda 2063. And this was first adopted in 2015. I think it might have been proposed a couple of years earlier. But it is where Africa wants to be unified and so forth for the next 50 years. And I was reminded by looking at this of the Club of Rome and something that they put out in 1973. It was a report called The Regionalized and Adaptive Model of the Global World System, and it was prepared as part of what they called the Strategy for Survival Project. This revealed the club's goal of dividing the world into 10 political economic regions, which would unite the entire world under a single form of government. These regions are North America, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Japan, rest of developed world, Latin America, Middle East, rest of Africa, South and Southeast Asia, and China. And the plan was published in a Club of Rome book called Mankind at the Turning Point. So this is interesting, and I noticed when I was refreshing my memory on this that some years back, some different Christian groups had compared the 10 region system as the 10 horns of the beast in the book of Revelation. And you'll hear mention of the book of Revelation from Alan in this talk. So, just a couple of things I'll put up if you want to dig in and see. I think what I'm really saying is that there is a part of me, American work ethic, that kind of brainwashing that we've probably, no matter where you are in the world, have suffered from to one degree or another as they standardize us all. And so I often feel if I'm not just bound to the computer, researching, reading the news, listening to things, that somehow I'm failing to do what I need to do. And there is a quote, I'll save this mostly for my discussion with Nick in the book We. But in the introduction by the translator, who is somebody Brown, Clarence Brown, he writes that in this system, in this one state that Zamyatin is writing about, the benefactor, who is like Orwell's big brother, the benefactor rules over a human society that is deemed to have achieved, with only negligible exceptions, absolute perfection. Men have finally become, if not actually machines, as machine-like as possible, utterly predictable and completely happy. All the messy inconvenience of freedom has been eliminated. And I thought of, the great work that Alan has, that he spent so many years telling us about, the great work, or doing the Father's work, down through time, these brotherhoods, these organizations that have brought this, the scientific priesthood, whoever's working on it, the great work. And in the Cutting Through, Volume 1, Alan wrote, "In one sense, the great work, in one sense, it promotes secular humanism, a world where everyone will be born with a specific function and a life of service to society, better known as scientific socialism. This would mean, for anyone who has studied it, the death of individuality, spontaneity, and personal creativity. On a much higher level, the completion of man is to be done scientifically. To prepare the world for this, chaos must be unleashed within society so that new laws may be introduced. The media and entertainment industry must prepare the mind of the people for the imperative need for a complete new system and a new you." And so this new, what we're given as news is really, as Alan often pointed out, just like wrestling. And it was only recently that I really understood in a deeper way what that wrestling analogy meant, because the wrestling world, this scripted conflict between your heroes, the face, or your villains, the heel, is enacted at all the time, so that a face and a villain can't be seen at a pub having a friendly beer, because they're enemies, right? And this is the way the news is presented to us and the characters who are in the news. So I think it's okay that I don't, and you don't, spend all of your time working, because what are we actually accomplishing? So, one last thing before I close. We've talked so much about other organizations, like the World Economic Forum, and so many different things have kept our attention, especially for the past 5 years. But I'd like to return, I think, to the Club of Rome for a bit, because some of the agendas that they put into play 50 years ago are very much on the go. And this is that quote that Alan Watt shared with us numerous times from a book that they published in 1991 entitled The First Global Revolution. In searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat, which must be confronted by everyone together. But in designating these dangers as the enemy, we fall into the trap, which we have already warned readers about, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention and natural processes, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior and that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. So, let's not forget that we have been deemed the real enemy. And in this talk towards the end, Alan said, we must regain our humanity, and truly this is the last step because the younger generation won't have the chance. People should not feel so overwhelmed because in times gone by, the psychopaths have accumulated at the top and caused a tremendous evil and worked it on the general public to the latter's detriment, but the people rally eventually and rectify the situation. Something that psychopaths are well aware of because they hire the best historians and have lectures by them on this very topic, how to maintain control. But we shouldn't feel overwhelmed because that which is human must always triumph if we want it to. We haven't, with all the work that's been done on us, we haven't all succumbed to the dehumanizing program of indoctrinations we've had since childhood. That's a really important thing to remember. One last little quote that I'll leave you with. I can feel my voice is going. This is a book that was sent to me as a gift a couple of months ago, Leisure, The Basis of Culture by Joseph Piper, a German philosopher. He writes about, it's Latin and I don't know how to pronounce the word, but acedia, children of acedia. It's a kind of idleness. Idleness is not a good thing. Remember, idle hands are the devil's workshop or the devil's tools, whatever that saying goes. So, idleness, in the old sense of the word, so far from being synonymous with leisure, is more nearly the inner prerequisite which renders leisure impossible, okay? So to be idle is the opposite of leisure. It's the very opposite of leisure, he writes. Leisure is only possible when a man is at one with himself, when he acquiesces in his own being, whereas the essence of acedia is the refusal to acquiesce in one's own being. Idleness and the incapacity for leisure correspond with one another. Leisure is the contrary of both. Leisure, it must be clearly understood, is a mental and spiritual attitude. It is not simply the result of external factors. It is not the inevitable result of spare time, a holiday, a weekend, or a vacation. It is, in the first place, an attitude of mind, a condition of the soul, and as such, utterly contrary to the ideal of, quote, worker, in each and every one of the three aspects under which it was analyzed, work as activity, as toil, as a social function. Compared with the exclusive ideal of work as activity, leisure implies, in the first place, an attitude of non-activity, of inward calm, of silence. It means not being busy, but letting things happen. Leisure is a form of silence. Of that silence, which is the prerequisite of the apprehension of reality. In other words, without silence, you cannot see or know reality. Only the silent hear, and those who do not remain silent do not hear. Silence, as it is used in this context, does not mean dumbness or noiselessness. It means more nearly that the soul's power to answer to the reality of the world is left undisturbed. For leisure is a receptive attitude of mind, a contemplative attitude, and it is not only the occasion, but also the capacity for steeping oneself in the whole of creation. Skipping just a bit, leisure is not the attitude of mind of those who actively intervene, but of those who are open to everything. Not of those who grab and grab hold, but of those who leave the reins loose and who are free and easy themselves, almost like a man falling asleep, for one can only fall asleep by letting oneself go. So thinking again about myself first, I shouldn't always tell you how busy I am. I should tell you that I have things to do. And thinking of Alan again, as he would say, I'm run off my feet or I'm on the floor putting together books. And I would think to myself, oh, the poor man, why is no one helping him? But as I got to know him and observe him, I understood that no matter what was going on, his mind was at work in a way that was at one with itself. It was a relaxed attitude. And in that way, no matter what was happening around Alan, he was always, in a way, in a state of leisure. I think it's a good thing that I'm running out of voice. It's nice to be brief. So take care and be well, be at peace with yourself, give yourself some leisure time in your mind, and don't feel the need to follow the wrestling match that they give us as news. Take care.
Hello, this is Alan Watt at CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com. It is 28th of March, 2007. Where I live, things never are still for very long. There's so much to do, with so many calls coming in, so many emails to answer. And then even these blurbs, although they're spontaneous, just putting them together with a few primitive things and tools can take a long time, because even tonight the mic wouldn't work, which meant checking everything all the way to the recording gear and so on, just to find out that the cable had basically formed a bad connection within the cable itself, inside the cable. And after going through all that process, and you have to swap your cheapo mic for another El Cheapo. So things don't ever go smoothly. In fact, I think in this world, if you're doing all the right things, the harder it's going to be. That's what I've found from experience. And I'm sure others out there have found the same as well. It's just the way it is. And it's quite comical too. Some of the shows I go on, if they're using voice over internet to talk to me, I often don't hear everything that they say. And since it's live, and that's the in a sense it's a beauty of live broadcasting, you must go along. You don't want to stop partway through and have the host readjust all their dials or recall, rephone, and get a better connection. So you try to get your way through as best you can. But the last show I did, and it was Feet to the Fire, I'd hear parts of sentences and have to guess at the rest. So I hoped my answers would match the questions that I thought were being asked. And so it's quite comical at times how things work out. But they generally do work out. Another thing I've found too, and you probably noticed, this pathocracy that runs the world, that basically gives us our ideas, our terminology, the phrases, the catchwords that people unwittingly start to parrot. They gave to the world the term conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist, as though it's a brand new kind of hobby for crazy people. And you'll find even some hosts that will introduce me as a conspiracy theorist, even though I try and stick to the facts put out there and published by those big players at the top, the ones who have the power and have the money and the standing in their own class to bring about that which they write about. And apart from that, when you've read their books and you experience the changes they're talking about bringing on down through the years, you know they're doing it, of course. So there's no real theory about it. In fact, H.G. Wells, one of the propagandists for this whole movement and one of the founders of the Fabian Society, paid for by the British Secret Service, actually called one of his books The Open Conspiracy, one of his writings anyway. He said everything's out there if the public want to find it. And it's true enough, it's out there, it's just not highly publicized by the bestseller book clubs that get you interested in drama and the latest written porn, which they call, they used to call love stories, now they're calling them something else, romance stories. But they certainly won't publicize the fact that there are books out there where you can find so much information on this whole agenda. I've mentioned before about the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which was set up to bring about global governments and to bring into it through, and it's a secret society as far as how they bring their members in, mainly journalists and movers and shakers, people who form the opinions of the people and create the opinions of the people, the talking heads on television and in major newspapers generally are members of the Council on Foreign Relations in America and the Canadian Institute of International Affairs for Canada, the Australian Institute for International Affairs in Australia, same with New Zealand, they've even got one in India, and a few other ones across the planet. You don't apply for membership, you are approached to become a member. And in the United States of America, they even put out their own journal, which is available to the public, but this is public info, but it's still enlightening, whereas they have their own private ones too, for members, and private books. And I noticed one, it's out for March, April. I didn't buy it because it was exorbitantly expensive, and after flicking through it, there wasn't much I wasn't expecting anyway, because they tell you what's coming next in the Foreign Affairs magazine, the mouthpiece for the public of the Council on Foreign Relations, the American branch of the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And Eden had one of their topics was the New World Order. That's what it was entitled. And it was to do with Africa, I believe, and what they see is happening to Africa and what must be done, etc. And what they see in that will be done, regardless of how long it takes. Getting back to some of the shows I go on, sometimes after I've been on, and introduces a conspiracy theorist, which is always said at the beginning of a show. In the last Toronto show I was on, that's how it was introduced, and that's the host putting into the public's mind a pigeonhole for the coming guest. So you're already labelled and almost diffused before you open your mouth. These techniques are widely understood, and interesting to actually have them happen on you as an individual. And some of the shows after I've been off, I go off, they'll bring on the next guest who'll go into the Bible or Revelations and even bring my name in, saying I'd probably agree with them, which is nonsense, because I explain things like Revelations in my third book. The real meanings, not the usual stuff which is meant to condition you into giving up. It's all preordained, and God says so. It's quite amazing how all games are played by different people who will use names to try and back up the particular spin on things. It's very similar to the ancient priests who used to pray for the sun coming up. And after a generation, those who'd grown up thinking, well, I guess if they don't pray for that sun coming up, it won't happen. And eventually the priests asked for certain donations and gifts and all this kind of stuff. And since the priests had access to thousands of years of knowledge of studying stars and comets and the rotations and the different appearances of comets and when they were scheduled to appear, and they did have that even 25,000 years ago, then they could predict that something ominous was going to happen to the earth, and only they could save it from happening, and people would go into frenzies of panic and fear, thinking it was the end of the world. And those priests would pray and pray when the eclipses came and when comets would come near. And it would go away again, and out would come the sun, and everything would seem all right, and those priests became incredibly wealthy. And it's not bad work if you can get it. Now they use psychologists and psychiatrists and scientists to do the same kind of thing, who project into the future what they see with their limited knowledge, and always gain power for making statements, and they get grants for doing so, to give more statements. Back in the 1970s, for the first time, a member of parliament in Britain spoke up and said, you know, we might get hit with a comet or an asteroid, and we should make some kind of new kind of category of defense to protect ourselves against it. And this was the beginning of what they'd been talking about, a threat from out there. Most folk think it was the alien invasion type stuff they were going to give us, and they tried that for a while to see if we'd all fall for it. But it takes an awful lot of novels and sci-fis to make us believe in that, and if you don't keep pushing out new amazing sci-fis all the time, it starts to winnow away again, because most people don't see aliens. Alien, by the way, comes from the root word, it means stranger. Yeah, but you know, they've tried all kind of con jobs to get us terrified, because government must terrify its subjects in order to maintain order over those subjects, and not only to maintain order but to guide them along a planned path. If there's no danger from anything, or we have no enemies over there or there or across that pond or across that river there, then people tend to go their own way, their own direction. They don't like paying taxes and keeping big militaries together and massive police forces that seem to breed almost amongst themselves. So they always have to have new fears. And they knew back in the 1800s when they discussed the possibility of creating global government. It was discussed before that, in fact, and you'll find that in the writings of the founding fathers of the United States of America. But they knew that why government existed, they knew why it would need to create fears, new fears in a peaceful society. They'd have to find some enemy. And that's why George Orwell eventually brought out 1984, where you had a world system with three blocks, the trading blocks, you know, that were to come into view, that would have wars between each other and alliances which kept changing, just to keep perpetual war going, so that the subjects, the citizenries, which are just subjects, will obey their superiors, the government, the pathocracy, this interbred permanent political these dynasties we seem to elect over and over, and with all the other dynasties that aren't the top level bureaucrats too, they're all interbred as well. They live in a world of their own. So I was pondering that today after making up a few books on the floor here, and that's where I do it. I generally do that when I burn my breakfast, because it's go, 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 just doing the little that I do. At least it's not a productive thing, put it that way. It's a lot I do, but it's not so productive as most people would define it, which generally means in your wallet. But I was thinking about that, and I got up and I took Hamish out and looked at the skies, and there they were with their crisscrossing, with their big chemtrails and new polymers, the polymer type that spreads fast, the kind that intensifies heat, you know, because they must create global heat to justify global warming. And when they make the polymers, it's like putting a plastic over the world. It intensifies the heat, it builds it up inside and reflects it back and forth from all these metal particles like mirrors, billions of mirrors, and you get very, very warm. And out of that, they'll also have storms, all kinds of storms. And then they'll point to the people and say, look, you're causing this with that little moped you're driving. You must change your ways, and we're going to ban them. And you must live in habitat areas where we can all watch you. And we'll have the local psychiatric association and local psychological association, and all kinds of experts taking care of us and evaluating us daily. And we will all be very good little citizens who don't much or have much chance to do anything else, because we'll be watched and chipped and monitored and evaluated all through our lives as we go towards the next step and the next step and the next step, which is all formatted out before us. But yes, this year we will definitely see an intensity of the heat build up with their beautiful polymers like magnifying glasses above our heads. The media will go into overdrive, and then out will come the Kyoto experts to tell us why it's happening with all their vast knowledge and abilities to predict the future. And all the NGOs, which it's called the Earth Army, by the way. NASA was the first to talk about the creation of an Earth Army. And what it was is millions of people who were brainwashed, belonging to NGO groups, the followers, following their leaders, who are all paid for by the big foundations. They'll demand that laws be made to change everything so that we live in harmony with nature, and how we're destroying the planet. We are destroying the planet. And the boys who own the big foundations that pay for these NGOs own all the companies and mining companies across the planet. Quite an interesting thing, isn't it? So yeah, I saw these chemtrails this morning all over the place, and you won't see that mentioned on your local news. But they will mention the global warming and all of that stuff. People are also telling me through emails that they are losing their memory. Young people too. they are going to do things, and when they're there, they forget why they're there, what they're doing. It's transitory. So it's very possible that there's other chemicals within this mix. It would make sense to me, actually, that there will be some kind of tranquilizers. Rumsfeld admitted they have that ability to spray whole cities with aerosolized Valium and Prozac in case of emergencies, and it wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they've been doing it. The long-term effects of these things are transient memory losses and some permanent memory losses, because your body gets used to certain doses, and as it wanes on certain days or during the evening and it gets a low dose, your body cannot kick in and take over. Your own natural chemistry really can't kick in so fast and take it over, and so you'll have these little transitory losses. Quite the world you live in. So I was looking at these trails and I was thinking, and I've mentioned it before, about H.G. Wells, the propagandist, talking about all the things that he would do, these scientific elite, and how science should rule the people for their own good. And then I thought about the movie 1984 and how they all tie in together on the same themes of totalitarianism. Only with H.G. Wells, he was an advocate for the elite running the show. He didn't think that the common person had the abilities to direct or plan their own life, or even be safe to be left alone to plan it and carry it through. Wells wrote The Shape of Things to Come, and I came back in the house after dwindling about this in my head. My head goes into strange places, you know, so much so it surprises me. And when I punched up the emails, it's just synchronicity kicking in. I got one from a tulip in Amsterdam with some of the words from the movie, the 1936 H.G. Wells movie, the old black and white version. And she'd written down what the black intruder named Wings over the world says. This is the Air Force that basically sprays all this stuff over the peoples to gas them into submission. What a coincidence. This is what he says. Now think of this when you look at the world around you today, and all the laws and all the control freaks that are all over the place now, who are running our lives. This is what the guy says, the head of the wings of the over the world. We have the airways. We have the seas. We have ideas in common. The Brotherhood of Efficiency, the Freemasonry of Science. We are the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed. We shall come here and clean things up. We go on, that's how things are. We are taking hold of things with science and government. In the long run, no man is indispensable. And the human things go on. We forever. The great John Cabal changed the course of the world. We're living through these times where science is, like Lord Bertrand Russell said, are controlling our lives. The experts are controlling our lives from cradle to grave. We're like cattle or sheep that are being weighed, measured, tested, blood drawn to test it, IQ levels done, just like a good farmer would do with his best stock, make sure he understands it perfectly. That's what's happening to the human race, the world over. The pathocracy that runs the world, who are psychopaths. Higher, the lesser psychopaths, but that means those who don't have, they're not born into power and money, position, the ones who will go into uniform or get a suit and tie and become a bureaucrat to persecute the people below them. They hire those ones to enforce all these things and make sure everything works for them. This runs along the lines of Plato and the Republic, based on Plato's own aristocracy of his day, when he talked about the perfect society, the guardian class at the top that would have a council. But he said, and people miss this part, he also said they'd have the nocturnal council, the night council, the ones who don't play by general rules, which most folk would understand, as above, so below, as they say. And Plato also talked about they would bring in people from the lesser classes, but the upper strata, to do all their work for them. The bureaucrats, basically. And the military class that would eventually be inbred. Because he knew, like animals, you can breed qualities in or out of any species. And when you really look at the history of the world, we've had a horror show, really. Something that's making some psychologists edgy today, just going over history, because gradually, very gradually, is dawning on some of them, and has been since the 70s, that the ones who end up ruling societies, and all societies generally, are psychopathic in nature. This doesn't surprise me, because in a monetary system where you deal with profit and wealth, exaggerated wealth, a morbid need for extraneous wealth, then obviously those who accumulate the most in that such a society will be worshipped by those who do not acquire all of the same goods. The wealth buys the armies. It creates them. It keeps them together. I'd like to see you try to keep an army together if you give them a bag of rice every day and kept them away from home for too long. I think nature would take over, and certain natural instincts would have to be fulfilled with young guys. Money is a deviancy, and it's a deviancy created by very clever psychopaths. There can be no happiness in this world and no peace in a monetary system. When you turn on television, which is now is just a bizarre psychodrama of horror and people getting blown up or shot down somewhere, sometimes by mistake, they tell us, like wedding parties. Over there, you know, over there, as the song goes. Mixed in with Hollywood stars, Hollywood murders, the black and the white of the higher lodges sacrifice, and all the things the public don't understand, but which are actually spells being cast over them. You're living in a surrealistic world where your mind drops out and downloading drops in. You're being programmed, and you're losing your compassion and your ability to reason. that these techniques are well understood within psychological warfare and military organizations and strategists. Surrealism is a form of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia, like other ones, other problems, are affective and cognitive disorders. This can be brought about by what we're being downloaded with and desensitized with, and it isn't by chance. Media wasn't always like this, by the way. At one time you didn't get sports or Hollywood or what the rich and famous are doing. That's been only in the last 15-20 years. Before, it would have been a crime, in fact, to show you some horror of people getting blown up and lying all over the place, and then switching to someone's latest breast implants, glittering with jewelry on the stage, getting an award. Neither would you have advertising stuck in between it, because that also makes everything surrealistic and non-realistic. These are techniques, Pavlovian type techniques. Eventually the mind will switch off and anything can be shown, but the subconscious takes it in and you're becoming dehumanized and desensitized. That way, when you see people being carted off down from your street by our modern version of the KGB, called the Multi-Jurisdictional Task Forces, the combination of military, police, etc., which are operational now within all Western countries, we won't be so shocked about it. In fact, we'll probably witness it and go back in and watch TV. This is the bizarre world that scientists, and it's true, scientists have created this. It was discussed in writings back in the 40s and 50s. Some people have asked me for book lists. In fact, I used to get nothing but phone calls where people would just pump me for hours asking about books, and I eventually realized I couldn't be used as a reference library for people, especially when you only have so much time in the day, every day. But I will be putting out book lists in the next work I get printed up. That way at least I'll get something back for my time. But for those who want to look into things for themselves, they can't go far wrong by checking the books I've told them about already on my talks. You can also check into the techniques of persuasion. They're in your libraries. People who can't remember what a library is, it's a place you go and you join and you get a little card, and you get these things called books, which are made of paper. And you can take them with you anywhere and read them. Even when the power goes out, if you've got a light, you can read them. And some of them are really informative. There's no flashing lights, there's no moving ads, and nothing like that. And no funny sounds comes off them. And I say this because some people, and some older people too, have told me they can't read books anymore. They can't concentrate long enough to read through a paper book. Something happens to the mind when you've been so long on computer and internet. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt whatsoever. There was a song out a while back called I Think I'm Getting Physical. I think it was, or going physical. And I sing, I think I'm going digital, because that's more appropriate today. I used to wonder why the old hippies always said digit. Well, digit is digit, digit, you see, D-I-G-I-T. All these little phrases that are put in there before the events, somehow so it makes sense later on. Going back to talk shows, now one of the biggest businesses today, which ties in with the whole New Age thing, I mean, you have a ready-made market now of people who've been bombarded with the New Age religion. You have all the talk shows to cash in on it. They call them Art Bell clones in the business, and there is a business on them, because you have the ready-made market. You don't have to create a market. And they're all doing tremendously well, because it's limitless. It's all imagination and limitless, and thousands of people are guaranteed to call in and tell you their ghost experiences and dreams and little stories, fascinating stories. And then they have all the latest hucksters with their gimmickry as well coming in, authorized hucksters, to spin us off into further la-la land. La, at least, is one note above the sun, S-O-L, soul, on the music scale. And when people are going through incredible changes, and fear and worry, there's no doubt about it, uncertainty, they look for something to save them, because people have always been terrified of dying. One guy wrote into me and he says, do you mean we're all going to die? And I thought, well, of course we are. Go around any graveyard, you'll find that that's what's happened to everybody before you. All I hope for is that we don't all die at the same time. Maybe it'll go on as it has in the past. Here today, gone tomorrow. But people are afraid of dying, because they're afraid of everything. If you're afraid of everything, you will be terrified of dying. That means you're not living now. Those who are rigid people and terrified of death cling either to established religions, and they cling to the formulas, and they try and make sure their children cling to them, and they were rather stern when time has gone by. Their own fear is projected onto their children. Now it's the New Age who project all their fears onto children. Not that there's any families left, mind you, to hold on to. But single parents still project their fears on to their children. And everyone's running, looking for an experience that will guarantee them something beyond this. And there's another thing in the human psyche, and normal, and this is the difference here, because, see, there, most people in the world, even though it's, we live in a great variety of personalities, most people in that massive variety are normal. Even with the little squabbles and the little fights and pettiness and all the rest of it, they're normal people. They don't seek power over large quantities of others. It's the psychopath who craves that. They live, they dream about that. That's what their fantasies are. A psychopath who's born into rich, wealthy families with traditions of rulership, dreams of conquest and a common enemy to fight. That was Maggie Thatcher's wish, and she admitted that on the BBC, that her greatest fantasy was to have a war and lead Britain through it like Winston Churchill had done. That's a psychopath speaking. Because the people below them are toys. We're just toys to them, toy soldiers, toy people. So when 9/11 happened, by pure coincidence, of course, after they'd written about the necessity of a Pearl Harbor type event to get this whole agenda underway with the Middle East, and bingo, they got it, they drew the right card and it happened. What luck. All the psychopaths went into gear. These guys sit and dream about this stuff. They fantasize about it. In little clubs of other psychopaths. And they can recognize each other. Psychopaths know they're different, but they can recognize each other. And they can cooperate with each other in a common cause, especially when it's benefiting their fantasies. But the history of this world seems to be, and especially since money came along, and armies were created and held together by money, and the conquering of nations began, and the empire building, and the accumulation of wealth in the hands of the psychopaths. We have a deviancy within us, existing within us, around us, and the psychopaths rise to the top. The ones who brutalize their fellow man for paychecks are just the lower grade forms of psychopaths. They're the ones who put you in trenches and shoot you in the back of the head. And yes, they have those guys in every generation too. They're psychopaths. It was interesting to read the histories of executions and the effects it had on soldiers who were carrying out executions in some of the major wars of the past. When Germany was killing off the undesirables, as they called it, various groups of them, they found they had a hard time keeping firing squads together for 3 days, because on the third day they found that the average young soldier began to break down. They couldn't stand straight, they couldn't aim straight, they would be shaking, and this is because of the inner fight of the normal person within them fighting with their indoctrination, and their indoctrination hadn't suppressed their own natural humanity. So they had to keep replacing these guys every 3 days maximum. The Soviets had the same problem, and the Soviets killed an awful lot more during their term. But of course they had a different term for all that. It was they had to kill them for historical necessity, they called it. The same term, by the way, that people like Bertrand Russell used for the supposed capitalist West, when he talked about his idea of his utopia. He also mentioned the need to take children away from their parents due to contamination of ideas from their parents, from old moral standards, etc., old customs. And he found out, of course, through experimentation, they could put them in kindergarten and scientifically indoctrinate the children and leave those children with the parents. But before that, he'd always thought, like the others in the elite of Britain, they'd have to take them from the parents completely, just like Plato in the Republic suggested. And you think this is all new. Brotherhoods, eh? One of the earlier books on persuading people in the marketing industry, at least made available to the public, was called The Hidden Persuaders. I think it was Vance Packard, but you can check it out for yourselves. He wrote a couple of books on techniques that you don't even realize are used in all the supermarkets and all the stores, and how even your pupil dilation is monitored with little cameras to see what colors the customer likes when you're walking up the aisles looking at various products. I think it was back in the 50s that they even made that book, or 50s or 60s. There's nothing new here. It's done surreptitiously, covertly. And then it's used by governments too, all this information, because governments must always control. That's their job, they want to control. That's why it attracts the type of personality that needs to control. We need data on how to be more efficient in control. Control freakdom. Planet Earth. Nothing is ever as it seems, especially when you turn on the magic box called television. There's not an item in a picture, even a still that lasts 2 seconds, to the side of a foot, to the side of an arm, wherever, that isn't debated and psychologically prepared to project a permanent photograph deep within your subconscious. That's why so much money goes into advertising. It works. And there is nothing they would not stoop to, if allowed, which they wouldn't use. The terminology they use concerning the public or the customer is degrading. But to them, it's efficient and it's practical. The terms like mousetrap, they build a better mousetrap to bring you in, whether it's like a credit card or whatever, a better mousetrap. And all these kind of terms, they even have categories in investing called wolves for themselves. And then the lesser breeds below them, down to the sheep at the bottom that reads the newspaper and follows the major investors. These are the terms that they use, because the ones at the top are psychopathic, you see. A psychopath lives on pure ego. They are what they believe. They believe they're winners. They must be winners. They're very bad losers. Very bad. They'll take the whole world with them if they could. These traits are well known to psychologists. I was going to say that there's many psychologists who are also psychopaths, and that's true. You have the ones at the bottom beginning to recognize the psychopathy within our society, which runs society, and they're only starting to realize that the big boys at the top hire psychopathic psychologists to explain how to control the people down below them. So there's no doubt about it, there are many psychopaths in different areas of control, and it's only natural that they would use those who study people in order to utilize techniques to control people on a grand scale. What a wonderful world we live in. I hope you excuse this rushed blurb, but it's been a very rushed day with so many things to remember, do, and it's not so easy when you're making up books yourself, you're burning discs yourself, sticking on the labels yourself, answering the phone, doing all the email, and then uploading this kind of stuff. But this is our window of opportunity before that slams shut too. I'd rather have an open window than a chip in my brain. And that will never happen, I can guarantee you that. No matter how bad things are made to be, we must hang on to that which is human. In a world which has tried to dehumanize us all, when we're all dehumanized, we'll fight each other. Those people in chat rooms, I'm sure, are experiencing that. I've never looked into them because I know why they're set up. I know what they do. And there's more disinformation there and slandering of each other than anything else under the sun. It's dehumanizing when all the egos clash with egos. The same will happen in general society if we allow it. We must reclaim that which we have the potential to be and which we once were. And we have to start pointing out those deviants who are planning this whole world. We've got to point out too all the helpers they have, right down to your local level, top to bottom. We've got to expose all of the secret societies that hide them, because that's where they get their start, and then the good ones are picked to go higher, often to other degrees and other orders. It's a sifting mechanism, Freemasonry and the Eastern Star, and all of the other branches they call themselves and hide under. And they all know to start to get up there, they've got to join these groups, then join the charities, get on the boards, and start canvassing doors and become little political helpers, and maybe one day they become a politician. The psychopathic personality. They're going to lie to the public and tell them all the things they want to hear and never fulfill the promises. And then they sleep well at night because psychopaths have no conscience. They're very good actors. They're the best, in fact. They do it naturally. If part of their brain simply isn't there. Plato's old technique of reading things out has been very successful. And yes, they would like us all to be living a disassociated state, the schizoid state, coupled with emotional disorder that Kreplin talked about. They're doing a darn good job, and now they're going after the last of the children who can still understand and ask questions naturally, to drug them, to make sure they don't become leaders for another generation. They want them all to have the dull eyes that you see all around you in young children today,